around the Eightfold Path, this path that leads to peace. So before we sit, I wanted to share a quote from Bhante Gunaratana from this book, one of our supporting texts for our program. And Bhante writes, "If you think that making the effort to force craving out of existence by sheer willpower will end in frustration, you're correct. The Buddha came up with a better way, the gradual training of the Eightfold Path, which impacts every aspect of our lives." So, Bhante is writing here about the source of our human suffering, right? Our desires, our cravings, wishing things were other than what they are. We understand this from the Buddha's foundational teaching on the Four Noble Truths. You know, the Buddha said, "I teach one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." So, wishing things were other than what they are, and a cure for that suffering is this Noble Eightfold Path that we are walking together. So I'll just do a guided sit now, and then have a little talk that I'll give, and we can have some discussion, questions, and all of that. So welcome. And take your comfortable but alert posture. And maybe if you're comfortable with a few kind of long, deep breaths, not too deep, but kind of long, deep. And as you breathe out, just let go of any hurrying to get here. The out-breath, letting go maybe of any stresses of the day. I'd like to start out with a sense of goodwill towards ourselves, towards yourself. So wish yourself well. We do this practice as a very deep way of caring for ourselves. So wish yourself well. And just feel the weight of your body settling in here. And now, the weight of your body on the cushion or the chair, sensations of your feet on the floor, anchoring you here and now. And if you're comfortable noticing the quality of your breathing in this moment, just notice, is it fast, slow, shallow, deep? However it is fine. Just noticing. And then starting with the face and moving down through the body, just noticing if there are any tense or tight areas. Relaxing the eyes. Relaxing the cheeks. You could even part your teeth slightly and then very gently bring your lips together. Relaxing the shoulders. Letting the arms just hang loose. Noticing if there's any holding, clutching in the hands. And you can just let them rest lightly on your thighs, all relaxed, or hold it in your lap. Moving our awareness again to the body, noticing are there any tense or tight areas still in the body, perhaps in the belly. You breathe into that area, relax it, perhaps the chest area. Breathing, relaxing. Maybe there's thinking going on. Just noticing, thinking about the past. Past is the past. We can let that go. We're planning for the future. Future is yet to come. But we have this moment right here and now. Body breathing. Relaxing into a sense of serenity. Here and now, all is well. And as we're nearing the end of our sitting together, you might check in again if you're comfortable with checking in with your breath and just noticing how is it in this moment now? The same as when you started? Has it changed? The ever-changing landscape of the breath. And our sitting together, a verse from the Sutta of the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Hello again, welcome. So good to sit with you all.
You.
Thought I would start with just a short review of last month's topic, which is the second step on the path, right or wise intention, from the wisdom section of our path. Right view and right intention. And our intentions shape just about every aspect of our lives, don't they? So if we want to live skillfully, meaning causing the least amount of suffering for ourselves and for those around us, we want to know as we speak and act, what is my deepest intention as I speak and act in the world? Why am I saying this? How is it landing? And we can remember from last month's teachings that as Buddhist practitioners, we want as the foundation, as the very root of our thinking, speaking, and acting, these qualities of letting go that Jim talked about last month, letting go of wantings and attachments. Kindness and goodwill and compassion, our wish for the happiness of others. And so we understand that when we cultivate these three wholesome intentions, we are on the path to true happiness and contentment. So as we are moving on together here from these first two steps on the path, known as the wisdom, our aspect of the path, wise view, wise intention, we're moving on now to the Sila group, ethical conduct in what we say and do in the world. And we see how important it is to be mindful, to see clearly, to understand what is my intention as I go about my day, interacting with others. And you know, the beauty of the Buddha's approach to ethical conduct is that he's not asking us to be bound by a set of rules, right? Where is the freedom in a set of rules imposed from somewhere else? We are on a path that leads to freedom. So, but rather, the Buddha is giving us a way of knowing, reflecting, investigating for ourselves how we speak and act and the fruits of those actions. You know, I think we're all practicing here because we want peace of mind. So how can we have peace of mind, you know, when we're regretting, you know, what we just said or did? Is what I said to my coworker in line with my deepest intention to create more harmony, not only in the world, but harmony within my own heart, my own mind? So the Buddha gives us a kind of measuring stick for what we say. You know, we can ask these four questions. Was it honest? Was it truthful? Was it timely? Was it useful? And did it create harmony or did it create discord? Those are the four key questions that we can practice with. And I really like how my teacher, Gail Fronsdal, puts it. Honesty, the first of these questions about honesty. Honesty is mindfulness out loud. Honesty is mindfulness out loud. And Bhante Gunaratana writes, imagine never having to regret anything you say. How wonderful would that be? How peaceful would that be? So for myself, one of the things that has helped me so much in my interactions with others, you know, with mindfulness, this practice that we do, I learn to take just a short pause before I speak or before I act. And I kind of tune in. I tune into my body, ground myself in that way. And over time, as I, you know, through this practice, as I slowed down in life, as I simplified my life, slowed my thinking mind, slowed my metabolism, everything, I found I was often actually able to choose what I wanted to say rather than, you know, that kind of autopilot, automatic response. You know, there's so much suffering in that kind of reactive way of responding, both inner suffering and outer, right? And so through this practice, we really begin to see the pitfalls of our reactivity. And we can see clearly that mindfulness, is the antidote, right? So our topic for today and our practice focus for the month is on right speech or wise speech. This is an outward practice, right? What we can experience and come to know and investigate through our practice is this inner landscape, our inner landscape. If you've been practicing for a while, I think you have a good sense of what I'm talking about. And we come to see how this, how our inner life is really at the root of what we're saying and doing out there in the world. And so, with this practice of turning inward in this way, we see how nourishment for our inner life, nourishment for our hearts, this is what gets reflective outward. It's just part of the practice. It comes with a nourished inner life, and we just spent the last 15 minutes or so nourishing our inner life. With our nourished inner lives, these qualities of letting go, of goodwill and compassion, they just naturally grow to be the foundation for what we say and do in the world. And, sometimes, we do find ourselves saying something to someone that may be wounding or hurtful. So we have these tools of mindfulness, to investigate, right? Investigate our inner landscape as, as we come into some solitude in our practice too. And then we can come to some understanding of how and why we said what we did. And we can feel the suffering that comes, not only for that person, but for us, the regrets that come with unskillful speech. I'm sure we've all felt that kind of suffering. And so this is what serves as a powerful antidote to repeating those scenarios of, shall we call it, unskillful interactions. And last, I wanted to share a teaching that has supported me, so well in my interactions with others. One of the teachers long ago, what is the definition of wise speech? And the definition, silence. Sometimes it's just best to keep quiet, right? So that's what I have to share with you today. And so now, as we do, I don't think it makes too much sense to break up into groups, since there are five of you here today, and that seems like a good size. So you can kind of gather together. And so I have something for you to talk about. So for this breakout, think of a time when you said something spontaneously without awareness and that you later regretted. And talk a little bit about the effect it had on you and the effect it had on the others or the other person who were involved. So that's the first part. And then after reflecting on this, what might you have said that would have been more beneficial, more skillful, with more positive, harmonious results for you and the other person involved? And I can repeat that for you if you like. But so yeah, why don't you just make a little circle as we do here for the little breakouts, and and I'll just come over and repeat it if you need me to.
Well, then we'll start here, and just looking for you to kind of share some of the things that you talked about, so that we can all hear them. Yeah, it seemed like it was you were in there a long time, good conversations, and
Well, we were all there.
what it, does anyone can anyone share some of the things that you talked about?
I can share what this topic brings up for me. Thanks. I'm thinking of recently wanting to do some racial equity work, and the guidelines in our groups, we're all learning how to talk about race. And one of our guidelines is intent versus impact. And I never thought about it before because I think I generally do have good intentions, but I have said stuff that landed poorly. And but I didn't mean it was what, is what I tend to say. But I, the more I work with this, I understand that the impact is what is important. And I want to say things that can be heard, not, rejected or get an aversive reaction. So it's really, I think it's really good to sort of hold on to what you're going to say if you know that it's going to be, if it's tender or something, until you feel like you have the right words or. And you're not always going to get it right.
Of course not, but at least at least we know that our intention was a positive and beneficial intention, so that we don't have to come back so hard on ourselves. After all, this is a learning process, this life, and interacting with people that we don't normally interact with on a very deep level. It's tricky, and I think that knowing that our intention was a positive and beneficial one helps us not to feel so not to come down so hard on ourselves. But yeah, that it's very complex, Carol. Thanks for pointing that out. Our human interaction is so complex. It's a learning process, this life. Anyone else like to share something from the discussion?
Well, I guess I can say it brought up for me that this is working. Okay. It brought up for me that the thing where I ended up being hurtful was something that I was. Felt like I was being honest, and I really didn't think of the impact it, or I didn't imagine that it would have the kind of impact that it did. And it does bring up for me that there sometimes can be a fine line between being honest, which is also part of right speech, and being being concerned about how the person feels. And sometimes I think that's where I sometimes get in trouble, is I sometimes, and not always, because I think I can be very cautious about how somebody feels, but there are times when I'm more focusing on being honest and not realizing how it might land when I'm doing that. Okay, so we kind of ended with talking about how it's, if there's any question, it's probably best to just wait to have it be timely.
Well, at least we have this practice so that we know when we're using honesty as a weapon. And people do that, and it can be very hurtful, and then it's really hard for the other person to really hear. It's very tricky. It's human interaction. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Maybe we should. How about the people online? If we, Paula or Tara, Adriana, do you have anything you would like to share? Oh, Paula, you're muted.
I'll
Yes.
just try to keep it brief, but we did talk a little bit about the importance of the pausing that you had mentioned earlier, Susan, and how, in my way of thinking, the pause can be a brief little pause before you speak right then, or it could be maybe a couple weeks even of thinking about and waiting maybe even to calm down a little bit from what you wanted to say, saying it emotionally. And I just wanted to say I was really happy earlier to hear you, Susan, say that developing that pause, that learning to do that will kind of maybe come naturally eventually if with enough, by the practice of meditation, of being more, that should increase the mindfulness in times when you're not meditating too. So that it should become easier because I know that's really a problem with me is just, blurting out things. So I am thinking a lot. I am thinking about it, and I'm choosing to stop doing it. But I so far I haven't been able to stop doing it.
Well, Paula, you're mindful now. You're on the path.
Thank you.
You're
Now
on the
that was
path.
very hopeful. I really liked it when you said that that will develop naturally. It's like, oh, great. Maybe I'm actually craving that. developing into a
It takes
craving.
practice. It takes practice, though. Okay, anyone, Tara or anyone else online, anything? Okay, how about in the room here? Anyone else like to share something? Okay, wonderful. Yeah.
I guess it's more sort of like a revelation that's come to me since our sharing, and now is that one thing that is I've been more intentional about doing over the last couple of years is especially with the work that I do, because it can be intense. I've realized that it's really helpful when I'm starting a day or when I'm walking into a scenario like a social situation or something like that, to kind of pause and just check in with myself, check out the landscape, the emotional landscape, like where am I right now? What am I sensitive about? How much can I give? How much do I need to hold back? And I think had I done this before I went into this scenario that I gave my example to, I wouldn't have blurted out something that was hurtful to my brother. And it was because I was having a lot of fear around finances. And I took on some extra responsibility at the last minute to pay his way for something, and I made a really mean comment to him. And I think had I been meditating more, had more self-awareness about what's going on with me, I probably would have seen that it wouldn't be wise to say that, or wouldn't be helpful. It wouldn't, so it's sort of unchecked, sort of. Yeah, anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we really do become aware of our triggers, don't we? And that's the first step, to notice, to be mindful of it, and we're on the right path. Anyone else have anything before we, I think we're due to take a little break here, but I just want to make sure that everyone who wanted to speak and share had a chance to. Anything else?
I'll share just real briefly. When I was listening to people that's now sharing, what came up for me was that notion, this really simple, basic notion that Ajahn Chah talks a lot about, we talked a lot about, that our practice can't end when we get up from sitting. Right? that the real practice is when you get up. And I think if we can remember that through the day and begin to have less separation between our practice time and our not practice time, that those get closer together and more together, it's really, really a helpful thing.
Thank you, Stefan. Yeah, it's, our practice is really preparation for getting up, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the best preparation I can think of. So well, thank you. Well, thank you all for sharing. And so we're going to take a little break now until about, is it, what is it, 2:25? Or what is the time after the break?
2:25 would be.
2:25. Yeah, so you can either just sit quietly, go out and take a walk, whatever, and we'll come back at 2:25. Thank you.
Well, welcome back for second part of the day. We'll cover some material that's the same, but we'll branch off a little bit. I think I'm going to focus a little bit more on practicing with all of this. As Susan was explaining, we're moving from the two wisdom elements we started to into the Sila elements. That's not the only way that the Eightfold Path is practiced. There's another formulation of the Eightfold Path called the Gradual Training. It was actually, I think I mentioned it in our first meeting, and it actually starts with the Sila elements, then goes on to mind training elements, and finally in the end gets to right view and right intention. So it follows a different path. That form is more frequently used for the monastics, particularly for the novice monastics that were entering into the Sangha. So I think it was kind of assumed that if you had gotten to the point in this practice that you were going to renounce the lay life and move in with all the monastics, you probably have some understanding of what you're getting in for. So that's one of the reasons I think they started with the Sila elements. And of course, the other is if they were going to enter into the Sangha and into the community, they needed to start someplace that helped them understand how to fit into that community, how to work with that community. So that's, I think, the other reason that it starts at a different place. But in actuality, in all of these, it's more a spiral than it is anything else. Because what happens is as you develop the wisdom, then through the wisdom elements, then you have a deeper understanding and a deeper discipline for working with the elements of Sila and then also the mind training elements, which leads to a deeper understanding of you and intention and sort of spirals around and around and doesn't really have an ending. So, you know, that's why, in a sense, you can start any place. You're really balancing out all of these elements as you go. So as a train, and part of the reason I bring that up is because part of the intent here was that this is a training. I mean, the Buddha in the Four Noble Truths was setting up the idea in the First Noble Truth that there is dukkha. There is this dissonance, this suffering, this stress in that we induce on ourselves that prevents us from having as much happiness and freedom as we would like. And then in the next two noble truths, he points out that the causes of this dukkha, this suffering, are mental states, craving, aversion, delusion, being the primary three that get identified as the poisons. And then in the fourth noble truth, he's looking at the ways that you can train, that you can make progress to take this out of your life, to let go of it, so that your happiness and the happiness of people around you can be significantly greater than what you might be normally or at this point experiencing. So this, in a sense, it's a cause and effect description. I mean, he's saying there's dukkha. Dukkha is caused by these mind states, these harmful, unbeneficial, unwholesome mind states. And these mind states, then how do you deal with those? And then the Eightfold Path becomes the training path for dealing with them, for identifying the causes of greed, the causes of aversion, the causes of these things, and working with them to limit them, to decrease them in your life, decrease them in the world, so that the freedom and joy and other things that are always potentially there become more available to you and everybody around you. So anyway, last month, at the start of when I was talking about intention along those lines, I had read from the beginning of the Dharmapada, in which it says, mind is the forerunner of all actions. All deeds are led by mind, created by mind. If one speaks or acts with corrupt mind, suffering follows, as the wheel follows the hoof of an ox pulling a cart. The second verse of that is very similar. If you step back a little bit from that translation, which is an English translation, into the original Pali for that, it actually comes out more literally at that mind states are preceded, mental states are preceded by mind. In other words, these things like craving, these things like delusion, these things like aversion that are causing this are in fact states of mind. They're not states in the world. And they have the mind as their master. So what he's saying is then he's pointing to the fact that in order to tame dukkha, tame the suffering in the world and in yourself, you have to tame the mind states that lead to it. And so that's why this is considered to be a gradual training path. And so there, although in many times when you work with these things, the focus is on what I'm going to do in the world. You know, I don't want to cause my partner suffering. I say things that I intend to be good and they have an effect that isn't. That was only really part of what the Buddha was trying to do with this. I mean, that's certainly an important way of living in the world, because part of his was the fact that there is no real separation between us and anything out there. It's kind of an artificial barrier that we create. And so our effects, our karma is going to spread out and do everything we do. But his intent in these teachings was also, if you want to change this, then you have to start looking within yourself. You have to start looking at your own mind. You have to start looking at your own mind states and the cause and effect that brings up all of these things to happen. So some of the times when they're talking about intent and that type of thing, they're not so much directing you out into the world and the effects on other people. They're also asking you to look deeply within yourself. What are your mind states? How do your intentions bring about your mind states? You know, my intention, if you were to go back to a very mundane goal, which we talked, I think, about last time, that having a lot of wealth should make me happy, then my intention of that is going to lead to a mental state of greed, of wanting, I've got to get this, I've got to get whatever. So by looking at that and asking questions about that, you begin to realize that intention is important, because intention is going to create the mind states. Those mind states are going to create the way that I interact in the world. So if I can't step back and start seeing the intentions and the mind states, I'm not going to affect anything else. Sthanasara once said, if you can't control your mouth, you're never going to be able to control your mind. And that's kind of what right speech, why we come out at the start of right speech, is that it is a practice to learn to see these things within yourself and how they start being created. Sila itself is, we call it ethics. If you, again, if you go back to the original etymology and Sanskrit that it came from, it actually means to behave appropriately. And that kind of changes a little bit of the way that it can be interpreted. It's not like it is in the Judeo-Christian world, in which everybody was kind of brought up with the Ten Commandments, an outside set of rules for what it is to be moral and act properly. It really, Sila, the elements of Sila are more what is appropriate action. And just like appropriate action in our world, it has to be contextualized. What's appropriate in one context may not be exactly appropriate in another. That's why you find there's a little bit of softness as around some of these Sila rules as to when and how they get applied. When, you've got to be truthful, and that's one of the things the Buddha says. And in fact, when he was talking to his son Rahula, he basically said, "You can't ever tell a lie. Even if you tell a small lie, you're throwing away your entire worth as a monk, because it's a slippery slope. As soon as you start doing that, in one case, it's going to lead to more and more failures. And so, the one thing that you should never do is tell a lie." But as lay people, we can't always follow that. Does that mean we're not practicing right, truthful speech? Well, it certainly is not as good for my development to tell a lie, a white lie, or whatever. But we exist in a world where we have other types of harmonies that the monks don't have. The monks have given up everything. They've said, "Okay, we're going to, rather than have to worry about keeping harmony in my community and working with my family and my wife and children and whatever else, I'm simply going to give up all of that up. I'm going to go into the Sangha, and I will have a bowl and a robe and spend all of my days and time focused on this one thing." Lay people did not do that. We don't do that, and you can't be expected, therefore, to live totally by the monastic rules. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be absolutely aware when you do that. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't absolutely be aware, if you choose to do that, why you're doing it. In this sense, there is a truth that has to be there, and that truth is that I know what I'm doing, and I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. And it has to have some other support of being beneficial to yourself and others and not causing harm. Even for the Buddha, there is, in the Jataka Tales, there is one story in there in which he was the captain of a pirate ship. I think I may have mentioned this before. Not a pirate ship, but he was a captain of a boat that's carrying refugees, and they were attacked by a pirate ship. And it turned out he tried to dissuade him, he tried to keep it from happening. In the end, he forcefully killed the head of the pirates in order to protect the people on board. Now, he knew, and it's very clear in the tales, that cost him. That cost him time in hell, according to the mythology there. But he knew what he was doing, and he did it because that was, as in the lay life, in the world that he was in, that was a necessary action. But it was done with full knowledge of what he was doing, why he was doing it. So there wasn't a lying to himself. So it should be remembered that whenever you're doing speech and so forth, this is not just speech between me and you. There's a lot of speech that goes on inside. In fact, almost all of our thinking is some form of speech. So right speech is as important inside as it is outside. That's an absolutely critical part of what we're doing here. And so along these lines, if you take the monastic precepts, they will talk about they're done in the negative, so there's not fault, no falsehood, not speaking unkindly, not speaking divisively, and not engaging in idle chatter. Idle chatter is another place where the monastic rules are much tougher than it is for you and I, because in monastic chatter was any gossip, any talking about kings, any talking things about sports, any talking about music, any talking about anything like that was considered idle chatter. They were monks, they were dedicated to one thing. Obviously, that again is not a restriction that can hold for us, because in your daily life, you need to make connections with people, you need to talk, you need to establish friendships. Particularly when you don't know people well, you're going to be engaging in idle chatter. But it's not idle chatter, because you know what you're doing. You are establishing that network of connections. You're working with people you don't know. hopefully you can maintain the other things of honesty and kindness and so forth that's inherent in that. So again, sila needs to be contextualized. It's not a hard and fast rule where you have to do this, but there are goals, and those goals are based on what is going to help you to be mindful, and because mindfulness is a form of truth, and what is going to be beneficial and help bring about harmony and so forth in your world. Thich Nhat Hanh, after I think considering these monastic rules, reformulated a little bit, I think, in ways that work a little bit better for the lay life. For him, the rules around this are aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I vow to learn to treat truthfully with words that inspire self-confidence, joy, and hope. I am determined not to spread news that I do not know to be certain, and not to criticize or condemn things of which I am not sure. I will refrain from uttering words that cause division or discord, or that can cause the family or the community to break. I will make all effort to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. So that's his rephrasing of the rules around speech for the lay life. So what are those rules? The guidelines are that you should ask yourself if what you're saying is true and factual. As I said, for the Buddha and for the Bodhisattva, the commitment to truthfulness is considered to be at the core of it all. Without being truthful with yourself as much within as anyone else, it's very hard to make progress in the gradual training. That's one of the reasons that in mindfulness practice, you're asked not to judge what's arising, but simply to meet it, accept it, and get to know it. Because if you fear it, if you condemn it, if you think it doesn't belong, and it's there, you're really put in a position of not being truthful with yourself about what's arising. And if you can do that, if you can be truthful about what's arising, this is the place where by working over time, it tends to solve itself. As you become comfortable with it, if you know what the effects of going one route or another, and knowing that in that moment, because you can see it, you have the ability to make choices, it becomes less of a problem. It becomes less of an issue. And in this case, factual, it has to be taken in the sense that it is objectively factual. I mean, there are a lot of truths out there, particularly in our modern culture, alternate truths that are really not truths. They're people's opinions, they're people's feelings, whatever. Those are all fine, but the truth that the Buddha is talking about is what's actually happening at the moment, what you're seeing, what you're experiencing, what's going on around you. The second thing talks about is that whether your speech creates harmony. And here it was aimed at not breaking things apart, not breaking the sangha apart, not driving wedges between groups of people, not creating divisions, which again is a kind of a problem in our modern society. A lot of the speech today is not harmonious. It's designed for polarizing, driving wedges between people. Is it gentle? Gentle does not necessarily mean pleasing. So there are all oftentimes you have to say things and that people are not going to like. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago in the conversation I was having, in the Tales of the Sutta, there was actually a one of the Buddha's rivals that set up was trying to set the Buddha up to show him up, and so he sent one of his disciples to ask him a question about that exact thing of, do you always say things that are pleasant? And the Buddha basically said there's no one answer to that. You can't do that. That kindness doesn't mean always making people happy and giving them what they want to hear. What kindness means is what is your intent? What are you doing? Are you trying to demean the person? Are you being sarcastic? Are you is this which is a type of aversion that's coming out? Or do you really want this person, even though you've got to tell them something that they may not want to hear, do you want to minimize the harm that's done, to do something that overall in the context of the situation is beneficial? Because they're not going to get everything you want, you're not going to get everything you want. The world has conflicts in it, and so you can't always tell people things that are pleasant, but you can when you have to tell them something you know that they don't want to hear. You don't have to do it in a way that's mean or derisive or anything else. You can tell them in a way that tries to be as kind as you can without backing down on your principles, without backing down on what you know needs to be done. If you do that, then you are engaging in kind speech. Is it beneficial? Again, there are things that are true, that, for example, speaking about things that cannot be changed, things of people, characteristics, peoples, and stuff that can't be changed, that may be absolutely true, but can be harmful, hurt people, not be beneficial. Those types of things, in spite of the fact that they're true, probably shouldn't be said at all, because they serve no purpose. They're not helpful. And then, are you speaking with a mind of goodwill? Is your intention to be helpful rather than harmful? So those are the characteristics. Then the final one he talks about, as far as speech is concerned, is at the right time. It oftentimes it's called timely. Is speech timely? I have another teacher that I've heard talk about this, and he prefers to use the idea that is it in the right context. That sometimes when you're saying things, like, for example, if you're criticizing something, it's probably not the right context to bring that up when you're in front of a large number of people, because it's going to do more harm than good. The person's not going to be ready to listen to you. So delicate topics that could be hurtful or could be delicate, probably should be paused for until you believe it's the right time. Because if you say those things and it's not the right time, they're not going to be beneficial. They're not going to help. Maybe in a different time, in a different place, they will. You don't control that. But by you being aware of what you are doing, taking these things into account, realizing how other people are feeling, realizing how you're feeling, these are the things that you're working on to train yourself to create a better world around you, and equally importantly, a more mindful experience within yourself. And then the other final thing I'll point out, and this is something that Thich Nhat Hanh also points out, is that speech is meant for communications. And so what you say is really only part of the process of right speech. The other side of it might be called right listening. There is a need to listen when you are talking to others, to what they're saying. We have a tendency sometimes when people are speaking to be planning our rebuttals and many other things rather than getting deeply into the communication. Part of the reason for that is that many of the truths, many of the things that happen in the world, there is more than one right way of doing things. And it's when you begin to understand the operations in another person's mind, where they're coming from, why they're feeling the way they are, and why it works or doesn't work for them to approach things in your way, is that when you start to create right timing and beneficial results. There was talking of the question of an intent versus impact. This really falls into that realm. If you're really listening to the other person, if you're understanding where they're coming from, what's going to be hurtful to them, what's not, rather than trying to put it out from your point of view, well, this is what I would find helpful. This is what I would find good. That's the point where you can start based on right speech to understand what your impact is going to be, and then start finding the right way of doing it, the kind way of doing it, the timely way of doing it, the beneficial way of bringing up what needs to be brought up. Because a lot of times when we make that mistake with our intentions, it's because we're not listening. We don't understand the context we're speaking in. We don't understand what the impact is going to be because of that. So that the listening part of it is as important to speaking as anything else. And that also then means listening to yourself. You know, we talk about meditation, deepening our ability to do all of this. Part of the reason it does that is it teaches to listen to ourselves. When I start to get angry, I start to listen to why I'm getting angry. What are the intentions behind it? What's happening? This is all part of this gradual training process that's going to be going on. So, how am I doing on time? Okay, so on that, I think we're about the end of the time I had for talking. So what I want to do is I actually want to, we'll go on to breakout. And I think what I want to do is work at that the last thing I was talking about, since it's an important part of speech, and that's listening. I would like you to think about and explore a little bit of when do you listen and when do you not listen? You know, the obvious, this is contextualizing things, both to yourself and to other people. When do you sit and ignore what the other person is saying about it and apply your own rebuttal to what you think they're going to say? So you're really inside it, not in a conversation, you're more in a one-sided dialogue. And what impact does that have on your interaction with other people, with your relationships? That makes sense. Okay, so we'll go ahead and break out and do about 15 minutes of that. And
Wait. Then I had a question.
Yeah.
You said something about he was going to have to spend time in hell. I didn't understand that because that seemed like a non-obvious
thing. No, there. Just say let me come back online and then I'll address that. Let's see. It's actually not non-Buddhist to talk about hell. There are, in Buddhist cosmology, there are several different realms. There are the three lower realms, which includes hell, hell of fire, hell of ice. There is the realm of the hungry ghosts, which is dominated by greed. You know, they're beings that are always hungry, and if you look at the pictures of them, their necks are so and so forth, they're so thin that they can't eat enough, so they're always starving no matter what. That's why they're called hungry ghosts. And then you have the realm of the animals, which is includes all of our pets and everything else according to Buddhist tradition, and that's a realm that is governed by desire and sense desire, and because they're not supposed to be thinking, and therefore they're driven by instinct and sensuality and so forth. The next realm up is the human realm, which we live, which is considered to be the most optimal realm because it has the mixture of freedom, exposure to those things that bring about such thing as a desire and aversion so that we can learn from them. And then above that are the realm of the Asuras, which are the demigods, and the realm of the gods. And so in classical Buddhist mythology, you are born and rebirth. You know, each time you die, there is a rebirth. It's not transmigration of cells. So it's not of souls. So it's not like it is in Hinduism. You're not this permanent thing going around, but your place of rebirth is dependent upon the karma you have generated in your past. And the problem with Devadatta was that he was trying to take over the Sangha. He was the Buddha's cousin. And among other things, he tried to have him killed three times. And that, you know, one of the absolute prohibitions in Buddhism is to attempt to harm a Buddha. And in one time, he shoved a rock off of a mountainside and it scratched the Buddha. And so the Buddha told him, "You're going to hell for that." Now, you know, it just depends on how you want to take the mythological stories of karma. There is obviously, they're not necessary. But it just like in current society, we have our mythologies about life and death and all of the rest of it. In the time of the Buddha in India, there the idea of rebirth, of this continual coming back into the body and leaving the body was the norm. And so when they were talking about this type of thing, they were talking within the context of that. So is it true? Don't know. But the fundamental idea of karma, of cause and effect, of conditionality and causality is absolutely critical to Buddhism, even if you don't believe that you have lives that you can somehow get to if you become fully enlightened, stretching back to the beginning of time. So, but yeah. Okay. Does anyone have any, I'll be the microphone bearer, I think, this time. Does anyone have anything they'd like to say about that exercise on listening as an aspect of race speech? Or what you talked about in your groups? In the room or online? Is it useful to think about right listening as an aspect of right speech, even though it's probably you're not going to find it in the Buddhist Suttas? No?
I can speak on that. This is Tara. I just really appreciate the framing that you gave earlier around the difference of, I guess, understanding right speech as a layperson versus as a monastic. I think that just, yeah, like also practicing with a level of kindness to ourselves and thinking more about how to be harmonious in our environment rather than like, you know, sticking to such maybe a strong, you know, idea of I will speak all the truth all the time, no matter what. So yeah, I just appreciated that that kind of distinction and how we can wisely practice right speech depending on the context of our environment. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I like to bring that up because particularly in our culture, having come out of a tradition in which a lot of that stuff is absolute, there's a strong tendency to mix the two traditions and make our practice of much more absolute. And I think for me, part of it comes out of the fact that when I started my practice, I started on the Zen side. And Zen tends to be much more rigid about the way that it practices. That's one of the reasons I made the transition to the insight practice and some of the others is I found them a bit too rigid, a bit too dogmatic about what was the proper form, the right way of doing things and so forth. And so I try and bring my opinions of that, I'll call it that, into this practice because I think it was helpful to me to make them less rigid and realize that a lot of this stuff is contextual, but there are reasons for why the various things are said the way they are. They are important to gaining our own freedom.
I spoke about being most aware of deep listening when I'm at home and interactions between my husband and I, because he, you know, we're casual and at ease, and often what will come up is something that triggers me, like let's say when we're watching TV or the news, and he just feels differently about politics than I do, and it gets me all riled up inside. But I feel like that's my listening, right? Is the feeling. And it tells me not to say anything. There's no point, and I'm not going to change his mind, is what I said. And it only creates more suffering to yeah, to have any kind of reaction, really. It's good to choose or pick your battles, or yeah, choose.
Anyone else have any insights they'd like to bring to the room, or questions about anything that's been done in the program so far, your practice? Yeah.
Yeah, this is kind of different from Carol, but also with a husband. I just was really thinking about how I haven't been listening as closely to my husband as I'd like to, and I want to work on that. So that just kind of came up that he's kind of the one person I do that with, where I kind of do tend to sometimes zone out, kind of taking for granted in a way. And I am.
Just one thought I had is that the connection or the relevance with listening and speech is that in some senses it's not really fully possible to practice wise speech without fully listening to what's coming. You get everything and you're paying attention. I'm thinking about this. I have many family members that when we're getting into conversations and sharing ideas, people don't let each other stop. People don't let each other finish their thought before they jump in. And often this leads to a lot of misunderstandings. And sometimes people get upset and they don't feel like they're being heard or listened to or respected. And it's interesting. And I think for me too, when I have paused and just allowed the person to finish everything that they want to say, I have more information from which to consider and respond, and it tends to be the happier outcomes, I guess. So just being patient there.
Anyone else? Okay. Thank you. That was useful. The only other thing I will point out, and it comes from some good comments, we've been talking about taking practice off of the cushion and into the world. This really is where that begins. You know, you're always speaking. You're always talking. You can always listen to yourself. You can always watch yourself while you talk. You can see what's arising in your own mind. That's ultimately what we're trying to do with mindfulness. And listening is certainly mindfulness of speech. If there's anything that is, it would be that. So if you're going to take your practice into the world, this is what you start doing. Is we speak.
Okay, we got a couple more minutes here. Why don't we just take maybe 5 minutes and we'll just do a short set to finish this out. It's always said that you cannot practice just for yourself, and obviously with speech,
That's definitely true. It's about harmony in the world. It's about moving into the world. So what you do here is very praiseworthy. You are working on a path that has proven itself over many years, over 2,500 years, to lead to greater harmony, greater peace. If you look at the Buddhist cultures, they're not perfect, but they seem to have less war and other things than some of the others, although they're not exempt from it. So this is practice for everyone. So we are gaining merit by this process, and I think it's useful to take that merit rather than keeping it and offering it to all other sentient beings, with to offer it through metta, to offer it through the benefits that it brings. You can't avoid it. Everything you do, everything you say is going to affect other people, and there's only one process here. We're just all part of it. So this practice is for all sentient beings, beings above, below, in all the directions. So it's worthwhile to take this merit and offer it to all of those beings that they too may find liberation, may find a world that is less painful, less uncomfortable, and that there will truly be less suffering in the world. So I'll ring the bell in a few minutes and we'll go from there.
Thank you. It's been great. I think we'll be meeting on January 14th next year. It seems like an amazing thing that it's going to happen that quickly. And tomorrow you should start getting your right action, information on right action, and so we can expand speaking into our action in the world. And Maria, did you want to say something for?
I think I can just speak loudly enough. We, as I think all of you know at this point, Insight Santa Cruz doesn't take any, doesn't charge for our programs or our classes, and we rely on the generosity of our members, and just please keep that in mind. We are, I'm on the board, and we are working on some alternate payment methods so that it's more convenient for people, and that's in the works, but for now, you know, we have PayPal, cash is always fine, but you can also do things when you go home, and it's whatever works for you, whatever fits your budget, but, you know, generosity is good for us, and if financially helping is not something that you're able to do, we always have a lot of volunteer needs, and I'm also the volunteer coordinator, so you know, come and ask me, or you can look online, it says volunteer at insightsantacruz.org, and you can fill out, we have a form, and I will get a hold of you eventually and talk to you. I've been trying to go out to team with people and just find out what people are interested in and trying to match them up with things that you know, would make sense for them. So anyway, so I know you all are generous, and I just, we're trying to say this with every get together we have as a reminder. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. And thanks for this wonderful program.
Mm-hmm. Any final comments from anybody in the room? Everybody's thoughts are important. If not, then enjoy the rest of the day.
Wishing you all well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.